Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
It's a new theme, but the same show. This week on Living Planet, we'll be looking at the role of law in protecting the environment.
Since 2008, vehicles here need a green sticker on their windshields to enter environmental zones. But this week, Germany's Federal Environment Agency reported that despite these zones, pollution levels in 2011 were higher than before the scheme came into force.
It's only law that can take interests that are less powerful and put them on the same level as the powerful ones. And the environment is powerless.
The EU drums up support for its energy roadmap for 2050, and we'll hear about greening up music festivals.
If you've got your event coming up, just measure how many plastic bottles come out, how much compostable waste could there have been.
Those stories coming up. I'm Nathan Woodcop. Welcome to the show. Soon we'll speak to a lawyer who can claim to have sued the UK out of investing in coal. First, though, to another environmental law. Since 2008, cars here in Germany have been required to display a sticker identifying how much particulate pollution the vehicle pumps out. The stickers are colour-coded, red through to green, and determine where you're allowed to drive. Without a sticker, drivers face fines for entering any of the country's environment zones. But this week, Germany's Federal Environment Agency came out with some disappointing news for efforts to curb air pollution. Our reporter, André Leslie, has more.
I'm standing here on a busy crossroads in Bonn, south of Cologne. In front of me are six lanes of cars and buses. Beneath my feet is the underground train line that runs north to the city centre. Opposite me, there's some heavy machinery going round the clock as workers struggle in the cold to finish a high-rise building. Business is hardly booming, but things are going along pretty well, especially in comparison to the rest of the Eurozone. As we all know, most business has transport and energy requirements as a major part of their operations. Still, the last 10 years have shown that Germans are getting the hang of how to reduce air pollution. Particulate matter levels in the atmosphere have been steadily decreasing since the start of the new millennium, partially thanks to stricter clean air rules for industry, for example. There's also new laws for cars. Since 2008, vehicles here need a green sticker on their windshields to enter environmental zones. These zones are mostly in cities. There's some 54 of them today across Germany. But this week, Germany's Federal Environment Agency reported that despite these zones, pollution levels in 2011 were higher than before the scheme came into force. So, are these zones doing their job? Well, beside me here in the sub-zero temperatures is Dr. Michal Krzyżanowski, expert for air pollution at the WHO's European Centre for Environment and Health. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Krzyżanowski.
Good morning, Carol.
Dr. Krzyżanowski, it's a cold, clear day again today. Does weather make a difference to the pollution we're breathing in?
Yes, indeed. In some weather conditions, pollution is not dispersing well enough and staying in place where it's emitted and then can accumulate. And this may lead to increased pollution levels.
So nice clear days like this, a nice constant stable weather condition would actually keep the levels high.
Yes, this is correct. It's, without wind and with this kind of stable weather spread over the half of the country, the pollution will stay in place where it's produced.
Now, here in the city centre, obviously we're under an environmental zone protection for the cars. Are these environmental zones working, do you think?
Yes, to some extent, not as much as we would wish. Certainly the number of cars with dirty engines with a lot of emissions are removed from the city centre, but they are circulating somewhere around, and pollution has no barriers, it's penetrating back to the city, so you would need to have a fairly big zone preventing those dirty cars to make them really effective.
Now, we see a lot of cars, trucks and buses moving around here today. Just how much of a role does transport, does road transportation have when we talk about the total pollution going out into the atmosphere?
We estimate that it's around one-third of particulate matter is emitted from transport sources, from the engines of cars and trucks and buses circulating around. This average in the city centers or in places like this next to the busy roads, the contribution of transport is obviously much higher. It's up to half of the pollution comes from the cars and other vehicles.
Well, as we can hear, a lot of different aspects to this problem. Thank you very much, Dr. Krasinowski.
Most welcome.
Andre Leslie was the reporter there, speaking to Michael Krasinowski from the World Health Organization. And we're going to stay with the theme of laws to protect the environment now as we hear from James Thornton, a lawyer and CEO of Client Earth, a non-profit organisation. Thornton helped sue the Reagan administration in the 1980s into enforcing the Clean Water Act. And today his organisation conducts similar campaigns in Europe. I began by asking him why the Earth should need legal representation.
Law is a really important part of environmental protection because when there is a disparity in power, it's only law that can level the playing field. It's only law that can take interests that are less powerful and put them on the same level as the powerful ones. And the environment is powerless against what we do to it.
I guess an implicit message there is that nature has no representative.
That's right. Nature is what we all are, but doesn't have legal representation unless lawyers are willing to stand up for it. And interesting to me, when I started looking into this about 5 years ago, I found that there were almost no lawyers anywhere in Europe who were doing this work of working with inside a nonprofit, a charity, to represent the interests of the Earth and all of the people who live on it.
So tell me a little bit about Client Earth. Your lawyers concerned about the environment?
Yeah, Client Earth is now a group of about 50 of us, and we have offices in London, Brussels, and Warsaw, and we're all international environmental lawyers, drawn now from 11 different countries. So we are very familiar with working across borders and in different cultures, but we're all united by the same ambition of creating a world in which people can live sustainably and fulfill their own purpose in life.
And you're a charity, so where does your money come from?
Well, like all charities, we go around like Buddhist monks with begging bowls, and we're supported by ordinary people, we're supported by wealthy people, we're supported by foundations, charitable foundations, and we also get money from some governmental charities.
And your activities, do you sue on behalf of the environment, or do you mostly lobby and try to help draft better laws?
We do some of all of that, actually. We do sue when we need to, but I would say suing is about maybe 20% of what we do. We also work on making laws better. So we'll write laws and we'll work with lawmakers in parliaments in Brussels or in the member states, and then work to implement laws and then sue also when they're not enforced.
I know it's only 20% of your work, but it sounds exciting. What does suing constitute?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a couple of examples, because it is, in a way, very exciting. So we sued the UK government recently to stop air pollution in London, and they admitted that they were violating the air quality laws dramatically, and now we're going to try and get them to change. We sued also, speaking of the UK, to stop the building of a whole new generation of coal-fired power plants, and that was successful. We're suing the EU government to try and get them to be more transparent, really, to force the release of documents about biofuels, documents about chemicals, documents about food additives, so that other environmental groups have the information they need in order to try and make things better.
Here in Europe, environmental directives are among those most violated by members of the European Union. Why do you think that is?
I think environmental directives are more violated than most other laws because there's not yet a culture of compliance. Environmental law is a new type of way that we have of regulating ourselves. The whole environmental movement is still not very old. Many governments will also think that environmental law is optional when, if you live your life looking at the environment, you realize it's incredibly important. I mean, there's even a Southern European, it's an Italian proverb that says, we go to Brussels to make the law, we go home to find a way around it. And that's all too true. And one of the things we're trying to do is to change that culture.
It's not really just a European culture, though, is it? I mean, around the world, environmental laws are frequently contested. And if I can just give a few examples for you to perhaps comment on next. Here in Europe, Spain's new conservative government has said it intends to relax environmental laws, which it says are holding back economic growth. China said this week it would forbid its airlines from participating in Europe's emissions trading scheme. And in the United States, the EPA has frequently been at the centre of disputes over its right to regulate greenhouse gas emissions or mercury levels in the air or the gas industry's fracking technique. Seems like environmental laws have many enemies and few friends.
You're right. Environmental laws do have many enemies and few friends. But what we try to do is to be the friend of the environment and to promote those interests, because the environmental laws, one needs to remember, are passed in the interests of all citizens. And citizens don't have many central groups in order to stand up and articulate their own needs, whereas industries have generally very well-paid and very well-heeled lobbyists who do articulate their needs. So you get a great many diverse industrial interests and governmental interests arguing against environmental protection, whereas environmental protection is actually to the benefit of the general population. It doesn't have much of a voice. The thing that the industry always argues is that environmental regulation is against jobs and against industry. And in fact, I've been studying the works of some economists at Oxford recently that show just the opposite, which is that what environmental regulation does is push industries to be more intelligent, to be more innovative, and to actually move in directions where they are more competitive and more successful.
When you were talking there about lobbies, I mean, there are green groups that have been around for decades. Do you think organisations like the WWF, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, they haven't been able to make much of a difference in securing better environmental laws?
I think all of those groups are doing great things, and they all do different things from what we do, really. I mean, what they all do is campaign, and that's enormously important. It brings to the attention of the public and to lawmakers what the issues are. But when you add the power of law to campaigning, you can achieve things that are otherwise not possible. If you campaign, what you tend to do is to say to the government, things are wrong in this way, and it's your duty to make them right. And what we do is to, frequently working with all of those groups, with WWF and Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and so on, what we do is to go beyond that and say, we all agree that there's a problem, here's the solution, and here's what it would look like in law.
Prior to Client Earth, you had some experience in the United States in the 80s, didn't you? Environmental law, successfully enforcing it there, I suppose.
Yes, well, I did quite a lot in the United States. One of the things I did as a young lawyer was during the Ronald Reagan administration, the government decided that it was going to stop enforcing all of the environmental law because it really did listen to industry lobbyists. So I was at a group called the Natural Resources Defense Council, and our question was whether citizens could use the law to enforce against companies that were no longer being enforced against by the government. So we picked the Federal Clean Water Act, and it has a very good system of information, so citizens can actually find out what companies are doing, and then it allows citizens to go to court. So within the first 6 months of the program, I had 60 federal prosecutions going in federal court that I was doing, and we won all those cases, and then we did another 100 cases. We won all of them, and then we embarrassed the government into enforcing the law again. So that's the sort of thing that citizen lawyers can help do, and it was quite successful, and I have to say it's a lot of fun.
But success at a national level aside, I'm wondering here, a lot of the problem is international in a sense, isn't it? Because the environment doesn't stop at national borders, but laws frequently do, and achieving good laws in one location can often, well, push polluters perhaps to another part of the world. And I'm thinking here specifically of climate change as a problem here. It seems like the problem at the heart of it is there's no international government that can enforce international law, is there?
No, you're right. There is no international body that can enforce global environmental law, and there isn't much by way of global environmental law. I mean, all of the struggles that we are seeing in creating a climate change act globally is a good indication of that. So there is currently a weakness in the international regime in enforcing environmental law. One of the things that makes the EU so interesting for me is that it's such a large group of countries, you know, 27 member states, such a large economy, such a large population, and it does actually now have harmonized environmental laws. So one of the great things about Europe from a global perspective is that when our laws do work here, and sometimes they do, then it actually gives hopes to large blocks of the world that they can agree on joint legislation that can be enforced and that can work. The global thing will take a while, and I'm one of the people that's actually hopeful that we will get climate change on the agenda in such a way that will create workable solutions and other environmental problems will follow. That will ultimately take probably a global environmental court to enforce.
Do you think those solutions will be solved by current bodies, though, like the United Nations and its fora for dealing with problems like climate change?
The United Nations is all we've got, really. And what it is a great convener. And what you need is the various countries have to themselves agree. You know, you have to get the countries agreeing. And in order to agree, they have to talk. And given how diverse the interests are, those conversations will necessarily be difficult and time-consuming. But what the United Nations, I think, has actually been pretty successful at is convening these international meetings and patiently persisting in them. And it really is just a matter of political will to make them go forward. That political will can be helped a lot if citizens everywhere demand of their own governments that they actually do take good proactive stances on these important issues like climate change.
James Thornton, CEO of Client Earth, a non-profit environmental law association. Thanks for taking the time to speak to us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
Time now on the show for some environment news from the past week. Here's Holly Fox.
Officials at the Grand Canyon in the United States are set to ban sales of bottled water. The decision follows concerns about mounting levels of waste at the national park. A series of water stations have been set up for visitors to refill their own bottles. The canyon attracts 4.5 million visitors each year, and disposable bottles are thought to account for a fifth of the park's waste. U.S. scientists say they have established a more accurate way of measuring sea level rise due to melting ice. In a study published in Nature on Thursday, researchers used a satellite that measures variations in gravity fields to study changes in large ice-covered areas. The team says the method paints a better picture than painstaking measurements gained through samples. John Warr, one of the lead researchers, said the Earth had lost hundreds of billions of tons of ice between 2003 and 2010, enough to cover the United States in 1.5 feet of water. The new method is important because United Nations forecasts for sea level rise don't include ice melt in polar regions due to a lack of data. Blizzards in southeastern Europe pushed electricity grids to their limits this week as demand for heating soared. In Bosnia, some 15,000 people were left in darkness amid the sub-zero temperatures of Europe's cold snap. Serbian authorities said the country needed to reduce its power demand by 10% to avoid a collapse of its energy system. Russia cut gas exports to cope with booming domestic demand, prompting fears of shortages in Italy and Croatia. Belgium, Britain, and Germany all saw gas prices and consumption spike this week. And finally, the European Union has signaled that it may be willing to alter its controversial rules for including aviation in its emissions trading scheme. A senior EU climate policy official said the bloc might modify the rules this year if international aviation authorities make enough progress towards a global deal. The US, China, India, and Russia oppose the inclusion of their carriers in Europe's scheme. Since 1998, a UN body called the International Civil Aviation Organization is supposed to come up with binding rules to cut airplanes' contribution to climate change. It has made little progress so far.
That was Holly Fox with the Environment News. And if you want to find more of our environment content, come check out our new webpage. It's dw.de. /environment. And in some other news this week, senior European Union leaders said that nearly eliminating carbon emissions from Europe's energy by the middle of the century may work out to be little more expensive than sticking to fossil fuels. It was one of the main messages to come out of a meeting with energy industry figures, civil society groups and academics in Brussels. The meeting was aimed at building support for the EU's 2050 energy roadmap. Sean Sinico presents this report by Christoph Hasselbach in Brussels.
In December last year, the European Union presented its plan to decarbonize Europe's energy by the middle of the century. The 2050 roadmap aims to cut CO2 emissions by between 80 and 95% by this point. This week in Brussels, senior EU leaders met with various interested parties to persuade them that the goal is good both for the climate and for business.
We are facing a financial crisis, a climate crisis, and a resource crisis, and they are all three deeply interlinked, and we simply cannot solve one without solving the other.
Martin Lindegaard is the energy minister of Denmark, which currently holds the EU's rotating presidency.
Europe imports half of its energy. From 2010 to 2011, the EU's bill for import of oil rose by more than 40%, costing us extra 100 billion euros. Euros that could have been invested in energy efficiency, in jobs, in growth in Europe.
According to the EU's roadmap, the cost of remaining dependent on fossil fuels could prove almost as expensive as making the large investments needed to get away from them. Investing in an energy transition will mean building thousands of kilometers of upgraded electricity grids, as well as more sources of cleaner power, more storage capacity, and better insulation for homes. EU climate chief Connie Hedegaard says this activity should be seen as an opportunity rather than a burden.
Climate protection done in a smart way is not about deindustrialization, it's about reindustrialization.
The EU's roadmap expects electricity prices in Europe to continue rising until 2030, but they could stabilize around this point and then start coming down. Hedegaard hit out at the idea that investing in the 2050 goal was too expensive.
Globally, for instance, government support for fossil fuel industry is about 7 times more than the government support for renewables.
Inside the European Union's executive, there are differences over how to reach the target. While some promote renewable energies, others are keener to see more support for nuclear energy, gas, and carbon capture and storage technology. Energy Commissioner Günther Oettinger says Europe ultimately needs to harmonize its electricity grids as well as its support for renewable energies.
Wir müssen dabei auch die besten europäischen Standorte in den Vordergrund rücken.
And we should also be keeping in mind the best locations in Europe. Wind energy where the wind blows, solar energy where the sun shines. Europe has it all, but I think 27 versions of the same subsidies is short-sighted.
Underpinning the roadmap is the fear that Europe could end up exporting its manufacturing sector if other parts of the world don't decarbonize their energy supplies as well. For Oettinger, where once cheap labor determined the flow of investment, in the future it could be cheap energy. Sean Sinico, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Finally today, every year across Europe, music festivals attract tens of thousands of revelers. Meeting these visitors' food, waste, accommodation and energy needs is no small task. Festivals can take on the proportions of a small city, as can their environmental impact. In recent years, there's been a push among organisers to reduce their events' footprints. Even big-name festivals like Lollapalooza in the United States are trying to make a difference. Our correspondent Cinema Nippard spoke recently to two event planners at a meeting in Berlin aimed at sharing solutions.
So joining me here are two speakers in Berlin this week for the first European Conference of Sustainable Urban Street Festivals. Can I just get you to both introduce yourselves?
So my name's Charlie Banks. I come from a company in Manchester called Sustainable Events Limited. We provide support to the events industry to implement sustainability strategies.
My name is Friederike Beer, and I run a small company and based in Germany supporting events, implementing sustainability management and measures.
What are some of the areas that organisers need to think about?
I think it depends on your event, what type of event it is, and your delegates, and what kind of delegates, what audience you've got.
A quite important aspect a lot of event managers told me is waste management, because the public recognize that it's dirty on the event side, so they are really concerned about their perception. Waste is a really one topic actually every event manager focus on.
And there's some really good examples of how events and festivals are dealing with waste. And I think in the Vancouver Winter Olympics, they have a big homeless community, and actually they give the homeless people a tabard, and they were responsible for collecting plastic bottles. And then for each plastic bottle, they then earn money. So, you know, they dealt with waste in a really constructive way that helped members of the community.
And so do you think that organisers are more aware of sustainability these days when they're planning events?
It depends. I think it depends who the client is. If the client is the city or the council, local council.
My impression is in Germany, it depends on the people who organise the event. If the person is interested in the topic in general, they try to implement it during within the event management too. But in general, the acceptance is not that broad, actually. So I think it's different in Germany and in the UK. For example, the Protestant Church Congress in Germany has an environmental accounting since the last 10 years, and they really know how much waste is generated, how much energy is used, from which resources the energy came from, and so on. They are really detailed on that. And other events are really interested in how the Protestant Church Congress is doing this.
I wanted to also talk about what kinds of guidelines and certifications are out there and who sets and evaluates them.
So there's for event sustainability, there is a British standard called the BS 8901, which was created by the London 2012 Olympic Committee and British Standards. That standard is now being developed into an international standard, which will be released later this year.
But I mean, this is a voluntary, these are voluntary guidelines?
They are, although there is a growing demand for a stamp of approval. More and more, we're seeing that actually it's the clients that are demanding the sustainability. So recently there in New York, AOL ran an event and their sponsor, BMW, asked for the event to be sustainable, and so they implemented the management system and they wrote a case study, etc.
But so far as I know, there's no legislation.
There's no legislation.
So an event doesn't have to be sustainable.
And lastly, what do you both see as the way forward?
I think that we're seeing more major events adopting sustainable practices, so things like the London 2012 Olympic Games and Paralympic Games, Vancouver, Winter Olympics, you know, the World Cup bids that we've seen, all are implementing or are asking, tendering for sustainability.
Yeah, if you start it, don't get disappointed if it doesn't work the first year, or if the audience doesn't participate, because it will be better. It takes some time.
Yeah, and I think the key thing is just to start measuring. Even if you haven't got the resources to implement sustainability, the first step is maybe just to measure.
Yeah, just get to know what is your impact.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you've got your event coming up, just measure how many plastic bottles come out, how much compostable waste could there have been, how much paper usage is there, how much lighting, energy use. You know, most venues can give you a reading if you just ask them. So start measuring, and then next year, look at how you can reduce.
I've been talking to Charlie Banks from Sustainable Events Limited UK and Frederica Baer from Eco Controlling Berlin. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you,
Arthur. Thank you.
Cinema Nippard was the reporter there. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Nathan Whitcup. Bye for now.